Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rurink, and our special guest this week, David Forsmark. He's a political consultant, does a lot of work in Northern Oakland County, Genesee County, Bay County. A little later, Kelly Breen. She is the state rep-elect in the 38th House District. She's going to talk to us from her pop-up camper. We're going to find out a little bit more about that and about her, but we're going to do that a little later. First, John, you know it's not a good thing when the governor has a press conference at 6 p.m. on a Sunday. You know something big's about ready to happen.
You got that right. And, you know, we talked about it last week and we thought something was going to happen. And sure enough, we got more restrictions. And this time through the authority of the Public Health Code versus the 1945 Riot Act.
So we are going to have more restrictions. And it looks like the divide is still real among the Republican legislature and the Democratic governor's office. But I get the sense, though, that behind the scenes, the real nuts and bolts that have to happen are still happening. But it's as if, like, the big stuff, like a mask mandate or codifying any type of governor restriction, is almost like just fodder for the base as far as, like, the division between the two of them.
It does seem like that. You know, if the legislature did want to play a role, they could have played a role, although they COVID itself kind of kept them from doing any work on that Thursday when the House had to cancel all its sessions. And now we learned that Senator Lozada had COVID when she was working in the Senate on Thursday. It does seem to be like we want to feed our base more red meat about this. And it's unfortunate because it doesn't help fight the whole disease.
The other problem we have here with the Republicans looking like they keep getting these COVID cases popping up here is what kind of lame duck can we expect? We could expect maybe no lame duck. And as far as the governor's concerned, if they're not going to do a mask mandate, she's all for it. Why bother? If you guys aren't going to do anything to address COVID, we don't really need you around. That was basically the message that we got this morning.
And it's interesting that the legislative Republicans seem to be facing the same fate that the Trump White House had. Think about it. The Trump White House has now had its third wave of COVID go through that building. And we are in what, our second with the state legislature?
But this one, I think, is more serious in that we've actually had events where somebody with COVID appeared. And so now you have to go through the whole quarantining. And hey, look, we had legislators who attended Trump events as well or other protests where there were a lot of people. Were they wearing masks? Some were, but some weren't. And you know, does it really matter if people were wearing masks? Sometimes you can still get it, even if you are wearing a mask. So the whole structure of the legislature and the number of people that are involved makes it very difficult to conduct business. And it helps the governor's argument that you need these types of executive orders in times like this because you know, the legislature just can't gather at times because of the very pandemic that you would think that they were trying to address.
Well, and that's the basic distinction between a legislative body and an executive body. Executive is designed to be able to run programs, to be able to act quickly. The legislative body is supposed to be delivered. They're supposed to set up the legal framework under which everything operates. I mean, it's just the difference between the two branches.
So if this executive order that we're operating under, and it's not an executive order, this is the Public Health Department, the Department of Health and Human Services has a public order. The legislature is going to be coming back after Thanksgiving, so they do have the ability to codify things. You would think that if all the COVID cases are all clear, people are going to be coming back. They could take action on this, and that would seem to be the top item on the agenda as far as the legislature. What do you think? What are the odds you think that we're going to actually have a lame duck?
I think they're very low. I think it could very easily be a sick and lame duck. One lobbyist suggested to me, it's kind of an awful strategy. But if you're a Democrat, all you got to do is claim you've got COVID, and you shut the whole thing down. If that happens, it's unfortunate, but I wouldn't be surprised given the political environment we're working in.
Somebody fake COVID? That's kind of Machiavellian, isn't it?
Shut down the lame duck.
Oh. All right, Forsmark, what do you think about all this discussion we're having?
Is there a 10-second runoff on the clock if you fake an injury? Or I don't know. I mean, lame ducks, productive lame ducks are when the legislature and the governor are all the same party anyway. So if she, anything she doesn't like, she can veto, and, you know, 58-52 doesn't matter. So, and basically the Republicans' big problem is the statewide part, the fact that you can't go county by county. If you're going to do the health department, we have county health departments. And, you know, if you look at what Frederick put together, that's what it's based on, is having county health departments have more to do with the regulations instead of the governor and her. You know, I mean, look, this is a governor who had a travel ban based on the fact that she saw Mark Campbell on TV say he got it from a gas pump. So, you know, saying she always reacts to science and data, restaurants haven't been tracked as the science and data being them being big spreaders and all the precautions they've taken. And it's just like, if you look at it, it seems to be anything she thinks is frivolous, she just shuts down.
We're obviously going to be keeping our eye on that. In the meantime, one of the big conversations in Lansing that is inevitable is the next political race. 2022, who is going to challenge Governor Whitmer for the Republicans? And when it's not an open seat, it's a kind of a different conversation, John, because you know that Governor Whitmer is going to bring some resources to the table. During this last election cycle, she wasn't on the ballot. She still raised $5 million. So she's already got a little nest egg to start with. We saw with the U.S. Senate race that we're starting to get into very expensive races. We had a $100 million race there for the U.S. Senate. I don't know if we're going to get into those numbers, but definitely we're talking about tens of millions of dollars it's going to take. And you got to wonder if the Republicans in that case want to do a primary. So before we get into our list of potential gubernatorial candidates, you would think the Republicans want to avoid a primary.
You would think so, but that's often something that they can't necessarily control because, you know, I mean, if you've got some money and you want to do it and the party's telling you, no, we want maybe one of our legislative leaders or former legislative leaders to be the guy or the gal, you can still run. You know, it's parties don't have that much control anymore.
So you have bigger primaries and open seats than you do, you know. A lot of times it's a lot easier to be the sole competitor for the nominee when you don't have an open seat. However, you know, you guys are just assuming she's not going to Washington?
I'm taking her at her word. I mean, she said repeatedly in national interviews and from the podium that she's not going to. To be honest with you, I don't think being a cabinet secretary would be as much fun as being governor of Michigan. I mean, you don't have an island retreat. You're a lot more autonomous as a governor.
I agree. I wouldn't trade.
Well, I think the other thing, though, too, is if she does have interest in being president and she wants to give it a go in 2024, it would seem like she doesn't want to be a part of the administration because you would think that Kamala Harris will want to run, and it would be a little awkward to run from an administration post. Then you're not really necessarily speaking with one voice. It might just be easier to run from a governor's position.
Well, I guess it depends on whether her polling is as off as Joe Biden's was.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she still has to win re-election, that's for sure. But yeah, I'm kind of with John. I don't really see her wanting a cabinet post. I don't know what he could offer. I mean, attorney general would be nice, but outside of that, I don't. You know, would she want to be HUD secretary, health secretary? I don't think either of those are necessarily more desirable than being governor. I agree with John.
I just couldn't figure out who was fueling all the talk all that time.
I think that she would naturally make a list just because of her visibility in this last election. But anyway, so let's assume she stays then. As far as a primary, Dave, how come the Republicans just can't seem to help themselves? It seems like they can't help but get themselves a primary.
Look, it all depends on how vulnerable people think she is. It depends on, you know, some of this is going to depend on what the, you know, the OJ jury comes up with for new seats, too. There might be senators who don't like their new map. So it's really hard to, you know, that might incentivize people. I mean, it's like Lisa Brown became Oakland County clerk because the Republicans reapportioned her out of her seat. So stuff like that happens, too. That's something else to think about.
So money, reapportionment, all these go into the soup when we're talking about who's running for governor. Now, if the Republicans could make a list of candidates that they'd love to see run against Gretchen Whitmer, who would you put as number one on the list? John, we'll start with you. Who do you think number one would be?
I think if you look at the field today, and obviously he's going to be out of office, first person I put on my list is probably Lee Chatfield. He's got a great ability to raise money. Obviously, that's going to change once you leave the speaker's office. But he's a good strategist, a good political thinker. I think he could run a decent campaign. And the question is, do you want to, he's got some political capital now. Do you want to spend it on challenging an incumbent, knowing the odds are long against you?
All right, Forrest Mark, who would be your number one?
I think the most appealing guy out there is Ken Horn, but I know that personally, he's my client. So I know personally he's just tired of this. And I don't think a statewide campaign, he's got two grandbabies, grandbabies and a new house and all this stuff. I don't think a statewide campaign is in his bailiwick, but he's got the intellectual firepower to take around, but he doesn't come across as that naked partisan. There's a lot of talk about John James, but I just think he should give statewide a rest. Just recharge and come back with something a little later.
All right, so number one on my list, I think, would be Candace Miller, the former member of Congress and the Macomb County Public Works Director. Proven vote getter. I mean, you take a look at what she was able to do in this last election in Macomb County. She received more votes than any other countywide on the ballot, and not by even a small amount. I think she was up into the 60s. Pete Lucido, I think, was in the 50s. I think other countywides were also in that ballpark. She just has a lot of popularity, and I know folks have been trying to get her for a long time. She's kind of seemed like the impossible dream to get her to run for governor. You know, some still think that if she had run in 2002, we would have never had Jennifer Granholm. Does she still have the desire, though? I understand that she's been approached and folks want her to run. I just don't know if she's got the fire in the belly, but if she were, I could see her clearing the field pretty quick.
Well, you have to remember in 28, in the last time we had the open, primary call, her husband was ill, and there was just no way for her to do it. And she was the most attractive candidate coming into 2018 by a long margin. He's since passed away. So, it's been long enough. Maybe she gets that fire in her belly. She did. I mean, countywide jobs are the best jobs in politics. It's kind of hard to. There's no term limits. The pay is nice. Yep. You make a decision. You make a decision twice a week. A big county and a big countywide job is easily the most attractive job in politics for personal stuff. But it just depends on what she wants to do.
I didn't mention her, Kyle, because it seems like I've been doing this now, going on 23 years or something like that?
Yeah.
4 years. It seems like more than any other story, we've had this Candace Miller tip her toe into this. Over and over and over and over again, and it's just sort of become like a broken record. Maybe she will. I mean, I think she'd be a great candidate, but
she's also got a free shot at it because she ran this year.
So maybe she will. I mean, I'd love to cover that race. I just didn't think about her because it's like I said, it's kind of been around that track so many times.
Every 4 to 8 years.
Yeah.
So it would seem like the Republicans, if they could get a female candidate, it would kind of neutralize any kind of gender issue that could materialize in the campaign, which is what we saw in 2018. Another name then along those lines that you hear is Ronna Romney McDaniel. I wanted to get you guys' thoughts on that.
Nah.
Okay.
I don't see it. The Romney name doesn't really carry anything in Michigan anymore. I think that's already been proven. I think that'd be one of those, okay, we got to run somebody and she's got the money, so let's do it. But that would not excite me at all.
I think she's more likely to run for chair of the Michigan Republican Party this winter after Kimberly Guilfoyle and Don Trump Jr. Take over the apparatus of the Republican National Committee from her.
Well, that's very possible. I mean, Laura Cox is there. You know, you wonder, maybe Laura Cox gives it a try. I mean, that would be an idea. But you bring up a good point, though, Dave, because once you become a state party chair or any kind of chair in general for a political party, whether it's state or national, it just seems like it would be hard at that point to cross over to try and attract independents or those swing voters that kind of end up making or breaking a statewide election.
Yeah, you kind of define the term party hack at that point, even if it's whether it's deserved or not.
So one name that we didn't put on the list, I don't get the sense that he wants to be governor, is Mike Shirkey. I'm not getting the sense that he would want to be governor, even though he might be in a better position than Lee Chatfield because he would have an office from which to raise money. But it doesn't seem like governor is something he's interested in.
I like Mike Shirkey a lot. I don't know if he comes across, on TV as that statewide guy. He's a little quirky. and he doesn't seem to be campaigning for it.
No, I think you are touching on something there, though, because it's not as if Mike Shirkey couldn't do the job. I think he'd do the job just fine. I think he's got a great skill set. But there is something about his public perception that he's become a bit of a Democratic punching bag due to things that he says out in public oftentimes become memes, and I'm thinking in particular most recently about this idea of herd immunity as being part of a solution, and now all of a sudden he's the herd immunity guy. What do you think on this, John?
I think you're right. I think the contrast that you could paint going into this election over the management of COVID-19 between Gretchen Whitmer and Mike Shirkey would make it very difficult for him to win, even if we're all well vaccinated by then and we're kind of moving on from the whole thing. I still think you can say, you know, look, she took science and managed it seriously. He was talking about herd immunity and battling everywhere.
Yeah, that's just kind of the unfortunate reality. I do agree with you on John James. I'm not quite sure that another statewide run 2 years after a loss for U.S. Senate's the best idea politically if he wants to go for that. You know, these statewide elections are taxing when you've got a young family. I can't imagine he wants to get in the ring again against another incumbent. That would be three incumbents in a row they would face. I'm not quite sure that's a good idea. He could come back again and run for Congress. You know, if he'd run against Haley Stevens, he might have won, for example.
Oh, not might have won. That would have been a slam dunk win. And now you might not have Haley Stevens to kick around anymore, because I can't see a map where Slotkin and Stevens don't get drawn into the same seat.
So anyway, so I agree with you on that one. Here's a name that, well, I'm going to go with this one first. So Paul Mitchell, now he left Congress. He's got some money, but I don't know if he wants to put in the kind of money that it would take to win an election like governor. I mean, does he want to put in $25, $30, $40 million into being the next governor?
Well, you just talked about Mike Shirkey. I mean, Mike Shirkey's Cary Grant compared to Paul Mitchell. So I don't see that. I mean, he might, to me, that strikes me as a placeholder candidate.
Well, the other thing is, listen, if he wanted to leave Congress because that was taxing, I really don't see him relishing in the job of being governor. It's a full-time, you know, 24/7, 365 kind of a work environment. So I just don't see it.
Here's a dark horse candidate for you. Representative Jack O'Malley. So this is the reason I'm bringing him up. He has developed into kind of a Facebook personality of sorts. He receives thousands of views on his posts in which he makes commentary on what's going on in state government. Lots of likes. I just tuned in on Friday and just watched him for a couple minutes, and I saw four people just throw in comments about how he should run for governor. And I know that doesn't mean anything necessarily, but you start hearing that over and over and over again as a person, that you've got random people who you don't even know who they are telling you that you should do something. I have a hard time believing he doesn't give it a look.
He's good on the stump. I mean, I've seen him with that medium-sized to large group, and he is good at it. He's got campaigns. There's no question about it.
He's certainly a great photographer too. He took the cover shot of our election guidance. I don't know if you remember that, Kyle.
He did too. Yeah, he's got multimedia skills. Well, you know, he's got experience in the media, and maybe that's why that he's got these public speaking skills. He's been a radio talk show host for years and years up in northern Michigan, but he's also got a very engaging, very common sense approach to a lot of these issues that I think that's why, another reason why he's developing a bit of a personality on Facebook, is because when you listen to him, you don't get the sense that he's just parroting some type of partisan rhetoric.
He's authentic. I mean, he is, and you know, you originally got me on here to talk about my house races, but
we'll get to those too, Dave.
But authenticity is the key. It really is. I mean, that's, you know, when you look at the races we're going to talk about later, they were who they were, and they didn't seem to be party hacks or he's got that. He's got that certain something If he stands up and talks, you think it's coming out of his head, and there's not some four-point memo he got from the HRCC telling him what to do.
All right. So, guys, any other candidates or any other potential people that we should add to the list of most likely Republicans to run for governor?
Well, their dream candidate, I think, would be John Molinar, but he is definitely an up-and-comer in the Congress. I don't see that yet.
The only other thing I can think of is that if there is some type of business executive who kind of rises up again, let's say like a Lisa McClain type, not that Lisa McClain would run for governor after she just won a seat in Congress, but I'm thinking somebody along those lines, somebody who's been impacted by COVID.
Still dreaming about Bill Laimbeer?
Oh. Yeah, Bill Laimbeer. Well, there you go.
That story's no older than the first Candace Miller for governor story.
But you know what I'm saying, Forrest Mark. I mean, I'm talking like somebody who we're not thinking of right now, who would be able to bring some cash to the table, and who is a new face, is somebody who can unite kind of the Trump faction and the Tea Party faction of whatever is left of that. Somebody who brings kind of some conservative values, but has some charisma. I mean, I know we're kind of developing our own like Frankenstein candidate here, but it seems like there's somebody else who could emerge at this time, kind of like how John James emerged. And we hadn't heard of John James before he decided he threw his name in, or
hadn't heard of Rick Snyder either. So
exactly like a Rick Snyder. So I think there's somebody who could be out there that we're not even thinking of, that we don't even know yet.
Maybe Betsy DeVos will run.
Oh, she'd get votes.
did anybody develop a vaccine? Were any of those people from Michigan? That would be a...
Oh, that would be great, wouldn't it? A Pfizer chemist who helped crack the code on COVID vaccine. That would be interesting. Well, anyway, let's move on here. Forrest Mark, glad to have you on. One of the reasons that we wanted to have you on outside of your political commentary here is that you were the advisor for the Dave Martin campaign in the 48th State House District. Before we get into that, though, what other campaigns were you involved in this past cycle?
Well, the three that the Washington Examiner said saved Michigan were all campaigns I was involved in. Ryan Berman was my candidate from the first minute he decided he was going to be in the primary against Randy Richardsville's girlfriend, and they told him he couldn't possibly win that too. And then Dave Martin, I helped HRCC recruit him. And then also the Bay City race, I personally did. I paid for a poll a year and a half ago because I was so convinced that was winnable. So those were my three big projects this fall.
So you went 3 for 3.
The Beeson one, he wasn't personally my client, but I did everything I could to push that as a possibility. And then Brian made it easy with some of his absences. But really, I think he was dead. He's not a good constituent guy. He's got that arrogant edge. He ran against a guy, calling him an advocate for the abortion industry, and then waited until after the filing deadline of his second term to announce that he'd evolved. And Bay County is still really, really Catholic, already changing. But, you know, the seat he's in was drawn to be a safe Democrat seat, as was Cheryl Kennedy's. And they weren't the kind of Democrats who were going to win those seats anymore.
And what kind of Democrat is that?
Funny, you brought up Jim Barsha when we were talking on the phone the other day. Jim got a huge landslide in Bay County, even though they put a Republican on the ticket, which, you know, they lost the drain commissioner to a guy who's well-regarded, but really didn't spend a dime on his campaign. So you've got to have some connection to traditional values to win in those seats.
And that was what was lost here. So what was the, tell me about this Dave Martin race, because he was somebody who was on our radar initially, and then I took him off, and then he seemed to kind of sneak up here on Cheryl Kennedy at the end. What was it this race?
The reason, you know, you went off and you probably, you know, I know everybody talks to you, so you probably heard that HRCC had dumped him. But they've got the same bad pollsters they've been using since 2008, who are appropriately named POS. I don't know why we're taking marketing information from people who will use POS as the initials for the company. But in 2008, we almost lost. I had Gail Haynes, and we got dumped by HRCC. And those same pollsters had told a whole bunch of people who ended up winning by 20 points that their race was close and they needed to pull their money back and all that kind of stuff. And it happened again to us this time. But in this case, Jason Wentworth stayed helpful and was getting some people to still send some hard dollars over. And Ben Frederick and Phil Green just stayed absolutely committed to this race. And they were the ones that really put, I was the catalyst, but they really put the Beeson race on the radar too. They were dedicated to those two races and they helped us keep the thing going with duct tape and glue. And you know, sometimes I just wonder, once we didn't have the bombardment of the kind of Lansing stuff coming in, that it was good for Dave. People saw Dave and his authentic image rather than, you know, than Dave just being the Republican nominee.
So it seems like from what I'm hearing from you is that these districts have just moved away from the traditional Democrat just in general. I mean, that the Democrats don't represent the values of these districts and that maybe the district really hasn't changed, but maybe the parties have changed.
The Republicans kind of haven't changed that much. I mean, Trump helped a lot in those districts. I mean, Clio, 1996, I had a client named Sandy Hill who had basically given the Republicans their first share after HRCC walked away from her and tried to pull her campaign manager, ironically enough. But we beat an incumbent Democrat by 35 votes. We called her Landslide Hill because she won by 35 and 75. But in 1996, Clio, the bottom just drops out with Bob Dole at the top of the ticket. And you're getting 20% across the top of Genesee County. Now it's Republicans win across the top of Genesee County. So that blue-collar, small-town couple, they just don't vote Democrat anymore.
All right, so what happened in the Berman race? We thought he was dead meat. How was he able to keep his seat among a changing demographic?
Ryan's authentic. Ryan's authentic, too. Ryan is Ryan. And Ryan, he was getting calls. Don't go on Let It Rip. Don't oppose the governor on this. Don't oppose the governor on that. And Ryan just goes out and says what he thinks. He's kind of a humble guy. When you see him in a small group, when he's talking to people, he's not a super fiery personality. He relates to people. He listens to them. And he's very accessible and he's out there. But that's definitely not a Republican trending district. And 3,200 votes is a huge, huge win. Mm-hmm. But like I said, you know, people who have their own message can think for themselves and can convey to people, this is what I really think and I care about you and I'm listening, you know, do a lot better than people who have their talking points written by the comm shop.
Hmm. Well, that's a good point. There was a lot of money spent in that district, too. I hear that district in particular was just blanketed with mailers.
Well, so was the one you're about to talk to in the 38.
Well, that's a good point. So I guess what was your big takeaway?
It was really a status quo election in a lot of ways. There was you can see some of the shifts, you know, in who votes where. The most interesting thing to me in the future is going to be without Trump, what happens in places like Birmingham, Rochester Hills, you know, the Bloomfields? Do some of those voters come back who are just basically voted Democrat out of disgust for Trump? You know, like a Nikki Haley would certainly play better in Novi, in Troy, for instance. How that settles out, I think the Democrats are 20 years or a generation away from getting blue collar people back. I think that's a permanent shift and it doesn't depend on Trump. What Trump did was make those people interested in politics. I'll give you an example. I was at a family thing with my wife's family. We're up north and there's, you know, a girl who's a bartender in a place in Macomb County who her and her boyfriend just don't seem like the kind of people you'd normally sit down and we have a big political discussion. And in the middle of the thing, I just hear her say, Bill Barr is awesome. And I thought, wait a minute, just wait a minute. How many bartenders of, you know, a 30-year-old bartender in the past even knew who the Attorney General of the United States was, you know? I mean.
Well, maybe it's because his last name was Barr. Maybe it's just because it was Barr and you were in a bar.
I whipped my head around, though. I thought, okay, there's a bunch of people who are paying attention to politics and don't like what they see from the party they were brought up with. How many of them keep coming out? Is a question, but you know, there's a lot of people who voted on both sides who won't vote every election from now on.
Right.
I mean, you're not going to have, you know, not 80% turnout. You're not going to have 60,000 people voting in state rep races all the time.
Well, good point. All right. Well, David Forsmark, thank you so much for the time. Political consultant up in Oakland County, Genesee, Bay County. Appreciate the time today.
And only Saginaw. I got a great track record in Saginaw.
All right. Saginaw. Saginaw, too.
See you later.
We'll see you, Dave.
It's easy to get lost in 2020's constant news alerts. I'm April Baer, host of Stateside. Every weekday, our podcast is here to cut through all the noise with conversations about what matters to Michigan. Our new daily Stateside podcast is out now. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.
Joining us now on the podcast is the state representative-elect from the 38th House District. Her name is Kelly Breen, and she is from Novi. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this week.
Very, very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself. Who is Kelly Breen?
I'm pretty boring. I'm an average working mom. I've got two little kids. They're 6 and 10. Today, they are in their hybrid program in school. My husband's a teacher, and I'm an attorney by trade, and I'm on Novi City Council. This was my second go at this seat, but I came really close in 2018, but I still have the honor and privilege of serving the city of Novi, and I don't know, I've just expanded my circle for public service a little bit. I've got a big golden retriever. I live on the north side of Novi, right by Walled Lake, and I'm coming at you from my office, which is a pop-up camper in my backyard. So
that is fantastic. So where are you from originally?
Well, my family moved from Dearborn Heights to Northville when I was 10. Northville is actually Northville Township, if you will. The part they live in is the 20th District, which is Matt Colazar, but part of Northville's in my district. I obviously did not stray far from the nest. Went to Northville High School. I went to James Madison College up at Michigan State, go green. And I went to Wayne State Law. And fast forward 10, 15 years, I started taking an interest in local politics. And in the aftermath of 2016, I decided that I hadn't done enough. I had not done enough. And so I teamed up with two then current council members, Andrew Much and Gwen Markham, and we ran as a slate for Novi City Council. I unsat a Republican incumbent, and that was 2017. So I've had the honor and privilege of serving on Novi City Council for a few years now, and now I'm headed to the State House come January.
Kelly, I was going to ask you if you talk a little bit about the district. Obviously, this used to be a conservative district. The vote tally you got, do you think Novi is going to stay Democratic, or was it a reaction to Trump?
I think it's going to stay Democratic. This has been a trend. If you look at each and every election, you see 2 or 3 percentage points moving to the left. The district is Novi, the one tiny subdivision that is Novi Township, the Oakland County portion of Northville, my hometown, Walled Lake, South Lyon and Lyon Township, and New Hudson, which is essentially part of Lyon Township. We've seen an explosion of population in this area moving further north and west. So the population of the Lyon Township area, although it's been very red, it is a little bit less red every time. And I attribute that mostly to the growing population, which is mostly young, educated voters and families with some of the same values that we see here in Novi. Novi is extremely diverse in population. We have a large South Asian population. It's just been going this way. And I think we've seen an unfortunate polarization between the parties. You know, a lot of the folks here are pretty moderate, but still left-leaning. But what it boils down to is we all still want the same things. It's just a matter of how we go about getting them. And I think this time around, I'm just the right person, the right voice to carry that message out.
So did you end up going door to door at all this year, or did your constituents kind of bristle at that idea?
I had precisely one person yell at me when I knocked on their door.
Really?
I actually started knocking. I've been knocking since 2017, pretty steadily, actually. It's just part of the job, and I love it. It's my favorite part of the campaign is knocking doors. And so I decided to start knocking. I want to say it was right after the 4th of July. I felt that I could do it safely. My literature is a door hanger. I would be masked. I would, you know, carry my hand sanitizer. So I would walk up to a door. I'd hang my door hanger. I'd ring the bell. I'd step back like 8 feet. And I would always wear my city council pin, actually, so people would know that, you know, I am already an elected representative. And the only person that was hesitant to talk to me was like, there's a pandemic, and, you know, there's probably 20 feet between us as well as a glass door. But and that's fine. You know, everybody else actually was very, very receptive, except for some of the Republicans. But and some people who didn't understand the no solicitation ordinance, which does not apply to public officials. But some folks, I think they'd just been in quarantine too long, and they were actually very, very eager to talk to somebody who was not an immediate family member.
What did you hear at the doors? What were people most interested in?
So there's a stark contrast, I think, from 2018 to 2020. In 2018, it was roads, school, water, roads. And after that, probably roads, and then schools. This time around, it was, for the most part, the schools. And that, I think, is due to the fact that there were a lot of folks like me at home with children wondering, holy moly, what are we going to do with our kids? So it, for the most part, it was the virus and schools, some with the roads and infrastructure, because we know that Michigan is not doing too well with infrastructure. We've seen some very unfortunate evidence of that. But for the most part, a lot of folks are just wondering how, initially the way it was, I believe, is how am I going to pay the mortgage and what am I going to do with my kids? And then it transitioned to, as the CARES Act dollars came in, still, what am I going to do with my kids? There are definitely some inequities across the system. One thing that we know now is like a third to a quarter of kids don't have access to the internet, whether it's because of infrastructure issues or the parents' inability to get internet, even out here, which is a wealthier area. But then, you know, I'm knocking on doors in a manufactured home park in Lyon Township, and this one poor mother, she was sitting on her stoop crying because she was a single mom with three special needs kids. And she did not have the resources to handle this, that she couldn't even get a Chromebook for her first grader. Novi was really fortunate to use some bond money. They were able to get one-for-one devices for every single kid, and that wasn't the case for other districts. So for that woman, I sat and I talked to her for a while, and I was absolutely amazed at the patience she had with her children. And she contacted me after, and I gave her some additional resources she might be able to tap into to get the help that she needs. Hmm. That's the job.
Tell us a little bit. How did your race go? Did it get nasty? Was it overall positive? Tell our listeners about that.
So 2018 and 2020, again, were pretty different. I actually had a good conversation with Representative Crawford the other day. I actually sit on Novi City Council with her husband. The Crawfords have a very long history of public service in Novi, whether they're in the State House or the County Commission or if they're on City Council. And so I would say in 2018, it was a more cordial race. This year, you know, I didn't speak to Mr. Turner, but I did see the fun mailers and attack ads, and those are never fun to watch with your kids. But, you know, bless my 10-year-old's heart, she understands what's going on. But this one, I gotta say, it's insulting when you are sitting in city council and you see all these ads saying that I want to defund the police, when we have a nationally accredited police department. I wish everybody could have a police department like ours. And they say, you want to defund it, when I'm like, every single vote I've ever cast about the police department has been for them. Like, you can just ask our chief of police. It's they get what they need to serve our growing population. But I would say that this cycle was probably more contentious than the last. My opponent and I are very, very different people. I'm very active in the community. I've served in this community. I've been around. I go to public events. People have seen me in the schools. And I've got a long history of service and an experience. So I do believe that I was the right candidate at the right time. But I would say that this race was, it definitely, there was a definite difference that you could see between me and my opponent. And I wish him the best. I'm glad that he wants to serve. But it was definitely a bit more contentious.
A lot of money was spent, too. Talk about that, because from what I understand, there was a lot of mailers going into Novi in the 38th District.
Well, you know, and then there's the ones that I have control over and the ones that I don't. And this was up until, I think, like the last week or two, this district was the number one targeted to flip, just because of, I think, the changing demographics, as well as the fact that I came so unbelievably close in 2018, that was 588 votes short. And so because this was such a highly targeted district, the help came flying in. And that was another thing different this cycle, is I got started early this time. You know, even after that loss in 2018, I got a couple calls the next day, and they said, will you give it a go again in 2020? And I said, sure. And so I started early. And unfortunately, you know, I had a primary. Some people say primaries are great. Some of us that have had them before say that they suck. I'm not a fan of primaries, because that means that the support that you really need to run an effective campaign is often withheld until after the primary. But at least this time, I believe that the House Democrats and I, we were more prepared. We were ready. And we got organized quickly, and the money just came. They came in a lot, and I was able to tap into a lot of the resources that I have personally do that. So the money was insane. And I was just thinking all along, like, I am so glad that I won, because if I lost, I'd have to change my name and move to another state after this amount of money has been spent.
So tell me about the pop-up camper that you're in right now.
Well, this would be a 2006 Coachman Clipper. It sleeps 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. It's got a lot of features. It's pretty comfortable. And unfortunately, because of COVID, we were only able to get it out, I think, once this summer. But my husband's already planning trips for next summer. He's very excited about it. So we like to go to all the Michigan State parks. We almost always go to a Michigan State park. I think my favorite so far was Harrisville, because there's nothing like waking up on, you know, Lake Huron on a summer day. And it's great. So, and it, you know, it works. My kids can come out here and study. I've been able to get my work done out here. And it's a good little camper. Hopefully we can upgrade soon. I'm thinking maybe a Rockwood Rue, you know, we'll see. But
you're in the camper because your husband's in the house, because he has to teach remotely.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I live on the north end of Novi. Our house is a very, very tiny tri-level, very tiny. And so everything carries. And I don't want to be in the house talking to you guys when he is teaching a coding class online in our front room. So that would get a little distracting. There's really nowhere in the house that I could go and be able to do what I need to do as well as he does what he needs to do, because he's there every day teaching remotely except for Wednesdays. But it's been great. You know, I'm here. Got my own space. It's a she shed, if you will. A she shed. Not a man cave, a she shed.
So a lot of other people have seen this camper then, because of Zoom.
Mm-hmm. Lots of people. I will be glad to send you guys pictures. It's quite comfortable. You know, I right now because of all this wind and everything. You have to like stuff sheets around little cracks to get some of those drafts to go away. But I got a space heater. There's a sink. There's, you know, most importantly, there's a fridge. And I've got some witch's hat. Blueberry lemonade goes in there right now.
Nice.
That I will probably have after dinner.
Nice. Anything else that about you that our folks might be interested in knowing about you?
You know, I'm just grateful to be here. I know that the position I'm in, being a frontline seat for this next term, there's going to be a massive target on my back. But I'm excited to get to the work for the people of my district. And we're not sure even what the district's going to look like in 2 years. I don't think this one's going to change too much, because if we go south, we're in Wayne County. If we go west, we're in Livingston County. If I go east, then that's Farmington Hills. The only way I think that it would logistically change would be is if it goes up. And I've already got Wild Lake there, and maybe somehow factor Wixom in. But I don't think this particular district is going to change too much, but I do know that the other ones will, considering that, you know, I think this past cycle looks like Democrats had 50.09% of all House votes. Republicans had 49.3% of all House votes, yet they still have a majority. So our independent redistricting commission will probably make some changes, but I don't think it's going to change in this one too much. I'm just ready to get to work.
All right. Kelly Breen, she is the state representative-elect from the 38th State House District. Thanks so much for joining us on the podcast this week.
Thanks so much for having me. I'll send you pictures of the pop-up.
Sounds good. Appreciate it. All right, and that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. And John, did you watch any football? You know, I was kind of hoping that the governor's executive order would cancel college football too, so we wouldn't have to watch more thumpings.
Well, it certainly would benefit the state of Michigan if she did, because the Wolverines are kind of pathetic. The Spartans are kind of pathetic. It's just, I would say.
It would give us an excuse, right? Oh, we couldn't continue playing. The governor shut us down. Well, darn.
Here's the thing, as a Spartan fan, you know, I'm used to having off seasons and watching losses every once in a while. But, you know, I like to be able to at least, you know, say, oh, I'm going to tune in to watch Michigan thump somebody, but they're not doing it either.
Yeah, instead, it's who gets thumped the worst, you know?
Yep.
Yeah, you thought getting right. Shut out by Indiana was bad, and then you saw what Wisconsin did to Michigan, and you're like, well.
That was a bloody nose and a bloody everything else, too.
That was bad news. All right. Well, until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.